And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State versus Reginald B. Briggs. Mr. Patterson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. For the record, if it pleases the court, my name is Ernie Addison, Jr., and I appear on behalf of the appellate, along with Michael Bianchi, my co-counsel. There are multiple issues involved with this appeal. I'm going to address them out of order. Judge, Justices, Mr. Briggs was charged originally with first-degree murder. He ultimately, after a two-week jury trial, was convicted of manslaughter. He also was convicted of use of a weapon. Now, the jury instructions involved in this case did not denote whether the homicide was voluntary or involuntary. Excuse me. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Thank you. Now, the jury instructions provided that manslaughter could be upon a sudden quarrel. That would be voluntary manslaughter. That would equate to an intentional act. Or the manslaughter could have occurred during an unlawful act. The jury instruction specified first-degree assault. And this would equate to the unlawful act to an involuntary manslaughter. And it would equate to an unintentional act. We're arguing that there's certainly a general intent crime that can be the basis for use. First-degree assault is a general intent crime. But there are different components of that, and we believe there's insufficient evidence as a matter of law to establish that first-degree assault occurred and can be used as a predicate offense for purposes of convicting the appellant for use. And the intent that we believe the record is devoid of establishing is based upon the record itself, because one can infer intent from the commission of the act and the facts and circumstances surrounding that. Here we have an individual who was charged with first-degree murder, which would be an intentional act. There was an instruction for a lesser-included offense, second-degree murder, which would be intentional. The jury did not convict him of either. They convicted him of manslaughter, so I think it's fair to assume that the jury concluded that this was a homicide that took place during the commission of an unlawful act.
What is the nature of your challenge to the use conviction? Is it insufficient evidence? Is it inconsistent verdict with the manslaughter conviction? Help me out with understanding exactly
we
what the nature
that
of your challenge is.
It's inconsistent with the manslaughter conviction because there's insufficient evidence as a matter of law to establish that the first alleged first-degree assault occurred.
When we analyze sufficiency of the evidence, do we look at what the jury found on other charges, or do we look solely at the charge at issue? And so if your challenge is simply to the use charge, are we solely looking at, is there evidence to support that there was an intentional assault or a sudden quarrel?
We don't believe there's evidence to support in the first-degree assault. We don't believe that there's any evidence to show that the appellant intentionally committed the assault. Not intentionally, not evidence referring to the result that came from the assault, but there's no intent that he had to fire the weapon. The record
was there evidence that he was threatening her with the firearm?
There was no evidence in the record. Now, the state refers to some allegations of a witness by the name of Ashley Jensen that said there was some acrimonious behavior between the two, some maybe verbally assaulted behavior at a hotel. That was some month in time prior to this. And on the day in question that the state alleges this homicide took place, the 17th of September of 2015, the only acrimony, the only argument, the only disagreement and confrontation was taking place between the appellant and Raynette Height. There was no argument, no threats, no confrontation, no assaultive behavior whatsoever in the record. It's devoid of it as it relates between the appellant and Ms. Longo. The record would establish that these three lived at a home, 6058 Buckingham. One of our other issues is we feel that the pandering that was alleged and he was convicted of should have been severed for many reasons, because we don't believe the pandering formed a factual basis that was inextricably intertwined with this. And it was so blended that the pandering had to be introduced into evidence.
Does the autopsy tell us anything about intent?
certainly the autopsy and the facts and circumstances surround the discovery of the body could provide an indication of intent. But when we look at 2210 North 39th Street, where this house occurred, in relationship to your question, Chief Justice, while there was electricity in this house, there was absolutely no functioning lights that worked. When the police arrived, when they sealed the perimeter, the only lights in the house were artificial. There were no bulbs, or the fixtures didn't work. The pictures, as reflected in the exhibits during the trial of the condition in this house, completely filthy, debris everywhere, trash, bottles, boxes. There was not a clean area in the house. And I suggest to you that the record, while one could derive an indication of intent through the facts and circumstances, the most direct evidence is Nathan Jandro's testimony that he admitted that the gun was, that he shot her by accident. And we have no other evidence of this. Now, this, we're not here to reweigh the evidence. Obviously, this court's aware of that. We're not here to reweigh the credibility of the witnesses. Yet, we can garner an indication from the jury's verdict that there was no intent because he wasn't convicted of first and second degree murder, that therefore the conviction of the manslaughter by innuendo has to be based upon an unlawful act, therefore first degree assault. There has to be intent to fire that gun, which would be reflected in State v. Sepulveda or State v. Thurman. Thurman's a good example where there's a sexual assault, the defendant's brandishing a gun, threatening with a gun. Certainly that acted to deprive force or coercion to do it. It was an intentional act. Sepulveda, after a party, individuals are running away, the defendant pulls out a gun after brandishing it earlier and showing it to his friend, fires in the direction of the people four or five times. There was an intent to fire the gun. Then we argue in the alternative then, the facts of State v. Pruitt or Ring, that the motor vehicle homicide was unintentional. I believe language in that would say that you can't, in reflection of an unlawful act, could the possession of the gun be an unlawful act? I bring that up why I'm focused on the first degree assault, because mere possession of the gun, you can't possess a gun to unintentionally commit another act for purposes of the use. So in terms of the first degree assault, if there are no lights in the house, it's completely messy, it's dark, it's nighttime, couldn't one have fallen over something and the gun went off? Somebody could have tripped, the gun went off. The appellant could have fallen. Cornus Longo could have fallen. There's nothing there to suggest that this was not some sort of reckless result from an accident as reflected by Mr. Jandro's testimony.
Could the jury have found there was some intentional act?
I don't believe that any rational jury could have found an intentional act from the facts in the record.
But didn't you concede that the autopsy had some indications of intent, or you could derive intent from the autopsy?
The autopsy yielded that there was a close proximate wound of a shotgun with a slug. If we were dealing with a shotgun with pellets and the gun fell, I think there would be a better ability to determine the facts and circumstances of how this occurred. Here, they're with a pellet. The gun fell, the gun drops, or somebody falls on the gun, and the pellet shot, there's only one projectile discharged. It certainly is possible that somebody could have been struck by that bullet during the course of an accident, as testified to by Mr. Jandro during the trial. And so we're implying that there's absolutely, the record is devoid of any evidence that could be used to provide the requisite intent for the use of this weapon. And within that argument, and in reflection of the question that the Chief Justice asked, we believe the facts and circumstances of the death itself are mitigated or further explained by the facts and conditions of the house and the testimony of Mr. Jandro. The state referred to the fact that testimony might have been self-serving. We're not here to reweigh the evidence. We're not here to deal with conflicts in evidence. The jury had to have accepted that, or he wouldn't have been convicted of manslaughter. And
or could the jury have believed part of that statement, but not all of it?
You know, we're not privy to their deliberations.
Right, and so we're just looking for, is there any evidence that could support the verdict?
Correct, and I don't believe the little evidence that could support the verdict. Potentially, I believe that the evidence contained in the record above and beyond that provides or removes the possibility of convicting Mr. Briggs of first-degree assault beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, I don't believe that the first-degree assault should be a predicate offense for the use of the weapon here. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant has assigned numerous errors on appeal, and I do not intend to address each one individually, pending specific questions from this court. I will start with appellant's assignment of error related to his conviction for use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony. Appellant argues that his use conviction was not supported by an intentional felony. However, the use charge was based on either an intentional killing during a sudden quarrel or an unintentional killing during an intentional assault. And the evidence presented at trial, taken in the light most favorable to the state as it is on appeal, supports this. The evidence showed that in the time leading up to the victim's death, appellant made comments to various people about not being sure if she was trustworthy or if she was fit to prostitute, comments about her not coming back with money that he thought she should have or not charging the correct amounts. He would speak to her in an angry, demanding tone, and she would respond by being timid.
Is this evidence relevant to sudden quarrel or a intentional assault?
I think both, Your Honor. I think the relationship of the parties is necessary to kind of help determine what actually happened in that house that night.
Can we find sufficient evidence of a sudden quarrel based on acrimony between the parties days or weeks before the event in question?
I think solely on its own, I think that would be a very tough argument for me to make based on this court's prior statements regarding kind of the provocation that's necessary for a sudden quarrel. But I think when we include in that in an instance he took her phone from her, told her she wasn't allowed to use it, in another he wouldn't allow her to close the door while she showered. Although she was earning this money, she handed it over to him, and she had to ask him for money for things like her insulin. So he's acrimonious, he's angry with her, and on the night in question he was angry, and as counsel correctly pointed out, it was actually with Height, but he was angry with Height because he accused her of being picked up by someone else, kind of a similar reason that he was angry with the victim in prior instances. They get to this home at some point. We don't really know a lot about what happened in the home, aside from at some point she was taken to this shower stall in a house that I don't believe had running water, so she wasn't taking a shower. Her purse was in there with her. She receives a close-range shotgun wound to the back of her head. Appellant returns to the home he shared with Height. He immediately showers, places his clothes in the wash. There was testimony that chemicals that had been near the washing machine, like cleaning supply chemicals, had been moved around. He asked Height to drive him to a nearby creek with the headlights off. He left carrying a bundle that looked heavy, and when he came back to the vehicle, he was carrying the same bundle, but it looked lighter. He later then went and told Jandrew, yes, he did mention this was an accident, but he also said to Jandrew he was trying to scare the victim. And then he told Jandrew to shut the house down, make sure nobody went in, and they discussed how to get rid of the body. And as I mentioned earlier, the victim's body was found in that shower stall with a close-range shotgun wound to the back of her head. The state believes that this supports that this was an intentional crime.
Is the fact that the jury did not convict of first-degree murder or second-degree murder, does that have any relevance to our analysis of whether the use charge is supported by the evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think where we hear now are on appeal. It's not why didn't the jury find these other things? The question really now is what the jury did find, is that supported by evidence in the record? And as I just kind of went through that analysis, the state believes the answer is yes, that there is evidence to support the findings of the jury.
How does first degree assault fit into this?
How does it fit in, like, legally? Yes. So the manslaughter instructions were specific, and they stated that in order to convict the appellant of manslaughter, the jury needed to find that he intentionally killed the victim upon a sudden quarrel or unintentionally while in the commission of an unlawful act, and the unlawful act was defined as first-degree assault, intentionally or knowingly causing serious bodily injury. So whether the jury found the appellant, the use was based on the manslaughter. So then the use charge was based on the manslaughter. So there was...
How do you believe there's first-degree assault without being intentional homicide? First-degree or second-degree murder? A shotgun blast to the back of the head. How's that first-degree assault and not murder?
Well, I think first-degree assault is intentionally or knowingly causing serious bodily injury, and he caused serious bodily injury. It was so serious it did result...
Most likely to cause death, which would be second-degree murder or first-degree murder, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that the evidence showed that he intentionally or knowingly caused serious bodily injury to the victim, and it was so serious that it resulted in her death. But I think that, again, what we're looking at here is there evidence to support that assault? And I think based on the relationship between the parties up to the time of the murder or of the death, where her body was found, how it was found, and his actions afterwards, don't support the idea that this was an accident or unintentional. And she did receive a serious bodily injury, and it was death, but it was a serious bodily injury.
How is that not second-degree murder?
Your Honor, it could have been. I think that the jury convicted him of manslaughter based on one of these two theories, and I think the evidence supports these convictions. Whether he could have been convicted of something else, I think, I don't know that that's a relevant inquiry at this point, because we're looking at, is the use charge supported by an intentional felony? In this case, is the manslaughter intentional? And both alternative theories of the manslaughter involved elements of intent.
I think at this stage we are faced with those convictions.
Correct,
which
Your Honor,
the
yes.
jury reached, not the ones that they might have reached and may well have been justified in reaching under the evidence. So that's where we're at, manslaughter.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now we look at those things that could go into a manslaughter and the sufficiency of those.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the state's position. Now we're just looking at, is there any evidence taken in the light most favorable to the state to support the jury's verdicts?
Does the conviction require a finding that if we set sudden quarrel to the side,
okay,
talking just about intentional assault, does it require there be evidence to support the notion that Briggs intentionally pulled the trigger but did not intend to cause death? is a lack of an intention to kill an element of the use charge?
To make sure I'm understanding you correctly, we're saying that he didn't have the intent to kill, but he did have the intent to have the gun out and scaring her with it and using the gun. We don't.
That's not terrorist. That's not first degree assault.
Well,
that's
and
threatening in a menacing manner.
That he was harming her.
Terrorist and threat.
I suppose that's correct, Your Honor, but that he intended to cause her injury, serious bodily injury. I think assault is a general intent crime, so I don't think we need the specific intent to kill her, but we do need an intent to perform the action that caused the assault. And I think we have that. I think, yes, he did state that the gun accidentally went off, but I also don't think that when viewed in light of his other statements that he was trying to scare her and the other evidence leading up to and after the death, that that was believable or credible or a reasonable inference to be drawn from the rest of the evidence.
Was there any evidence from the autopsy regarding injuries other than the fatal injury?
Your Honor, I don't recall that there was, and I don't know if that's the body was found approximately 2 weeks after after she was killed. The autopsy really focused on the injury to her head. I am getting close to the end of my time, so unless there are specific questions on other assignments of error.
Would you like to address your plain error on sentencing arguments?
Sure, Your Honor. In this case, two of the convictions for pandering, the district court imposed determinate sentences. And these crimes were alleged to have occurred both pre and post the effective date of LB 605. And I think under the version of Nebraska Revised Statute, Chapter 29, 2204, in effect at that time, those sentences would default to the minimum term of that sentence would default to the minimum term provided by law. In this case, it would be 10 to 10. With the manslaughter and the possession of a deadly weapon by a prohibited person, those both occurred, they were alleged to have occurred after the changes made by LB 605. And there were some changes, kind of some big changes to 29-2204. And I think that those two sentences will likely need to be remanded because the district court imposed determinate sentences. And the changes that the legislature made through LB, I believe it was 605, it may have been 1094, but it was August 30th was the effective date, took away the portion of 29-2204 that stated that when a court imposes a determinate sentence, the minimum shall be that provided by law. The statute, if I may
You may finish your thought.
Thank you. The statute now reads that a sentencing court shall fix the minimum and maximum terms, and that's subsection 1, and then subsection A provides that the minimum term cannot be, shall be a term less than the maximum imposed by the court or the minimum provided by law. And I think that now gives instruction to the district court how to exercise their discretion, specifically that they don't want, the legislature doesn't want a maximum to a maximum. They would like some difference in the minimum and maximum terms unless the sentencing court is going to impose a minimum to a minimum term. So I think that those two convictions don't automatically default based on the new language, and they will need to be remanded for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next